boyhood friends, Columbia teammates, players he coached at Boston College and Columbia, fellow football coaches, colleagues at Kodak, Apple, Claris, Go, and Intuit, business executives he coached, Stanford players who regularly crashed at his Palo Alto home, family, friends, and even kids at Sacred Heart he coached as middle schoolers on the flag football team. Many of them got choked up at some point in their interview. Bill created that level of love and devotion in the people whose lives he touched. We have been entrusted with a legacy, and know that this book matters to those who loved Bill. Bill was a delightfully profane man. He used the F word the way people today use like, almost as if it's a new part of speech, not verb, adverb, adjective, pronoun, or noun, but a word of its own category. Jonathan once sent Bill a study he had found, showing that swearing in the workplace enhances morale. Bill's uncharacteristically understated response, "A good one for me." There are numerous studies that report favorable effects of profanity in the workplace. It's good for, among other things, stress relief, honesty, integrity, and creativity. But before you go cussing up a blue streak, you should also know that other studies show that purveyors of profanity are generally judged to be less trustworthy and not as intelligent. Plus, your mom still disapproves. But as Pat Gallagher put it in his eulogy, "Somehow, when Bill did it, it didn't seem like swearing," he continued. "We'll see now what God thinks. Bill's been up there in heaven for a week now. Is it possible for the Lord to take his own name in vain?" Pat tells us that when shortly before his passing, Bill asked Pat to deliver the eulogy at his service, he did so with an admonishment, "Don't fuck it up." We're not sure Bill would have liked the idea of this book very much. He preferred operating behind the scenes, shunned the spotlight when it sought him out, and rejected several inquiries from prospective book authors and agents. But toward the end of his life, we believe he had started to come around to the idea. He wouldn't have cared for a biography, but he might have thought that a book that would codify his approach to business coaching and might possibly be helpful in carrying his legacy of success at Apple, Intuit, Google, and the like to other companies, now that might not be such a bad idea after all. We imagine him up there in heaven, leaning back, nodding, and getting used to the idea. Then he leans forward with a big grin on his face and tells us in his raspy voice, "Don't fuck it up." "We'll do our best, Coach." Chapter 2. Your title makes you a manager. Your people make you a leader. In July 2001, Google was on the verge of its third birthday and had recently launched the AdWords advertising product, which would soon propel it into the stratosphere. The company had several hundred employees, including many software engineers working under Wayne Rosing, a former Apple and Sun executive who had joined the company 6 months earlier. Wayne wasn't happy with the performance of his current set of managers. They were strong engineers, but not great managers. So he discussed his concerns with Larry and Sergey, and they came up with a somewhat radical idea that they brought to Eric. They would get rid of all the managers in the engineering organization. Wayne and Eric decided to call it a disorg, all those software engineers reporting directly to Wayne. Larry and Sergey loved the idea. Neither of them had ever worked in a formal business before, and both liked the less structured environment of a university, where students come together for projects, often under the auspices of an advisor, and none are managed. Coming from the academic world, they had always been skeptical of the role of a manager. Why do you need a manager? Why not just let these super-talented engineers work on projects, and when the project is done, or their work on the project is done, they can go pick another project? If company execs needed to know how a particular project was going, why talk to a manager who may not be actually doing the work? Why not just go talk to the engineer? Never mind that the first manager was probably created within minutes of the first company. If not before the first company, as Peter Drucker astutely pointed out, the greatest manager of all time was probably the fellow who managed the building of the first pyramid in Egypt some 4,500 years ago. This was Google, where convention went to die. And so started Google's experiment of running a fast-moving product development team without managers. This was right around the time that Bill started working with the company. Larry and Sergey were just getting used to working alongside Eric, and now they had yet another newcomer hanging around. Bill took his time getting to know Eric, Larry, Sergey, and other members of the executive team, mostly by dropping by in the evenings when things were more relaxed. He spent the time talking to people about what they were doing and their vision for the company, getting to know the company and the culture. During one of these conversations, Bill mentioned to Larry that, "We have to get some managers in here." Larry was nonplussed. After all, he had just gotten rid of all the managers, and he was quite happy with that. Why does a company of several hundred employees, shipping a product that would eventually generate billions in revenue, need managers? Weren't we doing better without them? This went on for a while, the argument going back and forth, both men firm in their convictions. Finally, Bill took a page from Larry's book and suggested that they just go talk to the engineers. He, Larry, and Sergey wandered down the hall until they found a couple of software engineers working. Bill asked one of them if he wanted a manager. "Yes," came the response. "Why?" "I want someone I can learn from and someone to break ties." They chatted with several software engineers that night, and most of the responses were similar. These engineers liked being managed, as long as their manager was someone from whom they could learn something, and someone who helped make decisions. Bill was right. Although it took a while to convince the founders of this, Google Engineering continued in disorg mode for more than a year, we finally called it quits and brought back people managers near the end of 2002. In fact, academic research finds merit in both approaches. A 1991 study finds that when a company is in the implementation stage of an innovation, such as when Google was developing its search engine and AdWords, they need managers to help coordinate resources and resolve conflicts. However, a 2005 study finds that creativity flourishes in environments, such as Broadway shows, that are more network-oriented than hierarchical. So there's always tension between creativity and operational efficiency. To Bill, being an executive of a successful company is all about management, about creating operational excellence. As a manager and CEO, Bill was very good at making sure his teams delivered. He brought people together and created a strong team culture, but never lost sight of the fact that results mattered, and that they were a direct result of good management. "You have to think about how you're going to run a meeting," he told a group of Googlers in a management seminar. "How are you going to run an operations review? You've got to be able to look at someone in a one-on-one and know how to help them course correct. People who are successful run their companies well. They have good processes. They make sure their people are accountable. They know how to hire great people, how to evaluate them, and give them feedback. And they pay them well." Silicon Valley people can get off track, chasing other goals beyond running a good operation. Bill was very good at making sure that it's a results-oriented game. We're going to come together to have a team culture, but it's to achieve results. Research backs Bill up on this point. A comprehensive 2017 study on manufacturing plants across the United States found that the ones that adopted performance-oriented management techniques, such as monitoring, targeting, and incentives, performed much better than other plants. Good management practices were as important as R&D and IT investments and worker skill level. Good management matters in creative endeavors as well. A 2012 study showed that in the video game industry, strong middle management accounted for 22% of the variance in revenue, while game creative design accounted for only 7%. Bill felt that leadership was something that evolved as a result of management excellence. How do you bring people around and help them flourish in your environment? It's not by being a dictator. It's not by telling them what the hell to do. It's making sure that they feel valued by being in the room with you. Listen. Pay attention. This is what great managers do. Harvard Business School professor Linda Hill, who studies management and first-time managers in particular, agrees that being a dictator doesn't work. She wrote in 2007, "New managers soon learn that when direct reports are told to do something, they don't necessarily respond. In fact, the more talented the subordinate, the less likely she is to simply follow orders." A manager's authority, she concludes, emerges only as the manager establishes credibility with subordinates, peers, and superiors. Another study concludes that people don't just chafe against an authoritarian management style, but are also more likely to leave the team altogether. Or, as Bill liked to say, if you're a great manager, your people will make you a leader. They acclaim that, not you. He attributed this mantra to Donna Dubinsky and usually included the not-so-flattering story behind it. Donna worked with Bill at Apple and Claris, the software company that was spun out of Apple. Bill had been a big shot at Apple, VP of sales and marketing, and had been very successful at Kodak. In both companies, he had been detail-oriented, frequently micromanaging his team members. That worked pretty well. So when he took on the CEO role at Claris, he figured it was his job to tell everyone what to do, which he did. Late one afternoon, Donna dropped by Bill's office and told them that if he was going to tell everyone what to do, they were all going to quit and go back to Apple. No one wanted to work for a dictator. After Donna left Claris, she became CEO of Palm, makers of the Palm Pilot. Later, she was CEO of Handspring and lead trustee for Yale University, and she is currently the CEO of Numenta, a machine intelligence company. She added a bit more wisdom for the first-time CEO. Bill, your title makes you a manager. Your people make you a leader. Bill took that to heart. He once sent a note to a valuable manager who was struggling, counseling him that, "You have demanded respect rather than having it accrue to you. You need to project humility, a selflessness, that projects that you care about the company and about people." He was concerned that people he worked with would mistake charisma for leadership, which was somewhat surprising, coming from a man who worked closely with Steve Jobs, the poster child for a charismatic business leader, for nearly 3 decades. But Bill believed that Jobs wasn't a great leader during his first stint at Apple, which ended when John Sculley and the board removed him from the company in 1985. When Jobs returned to Apple as CEO in 1997, after Apple had purchased his company Next, Bill saw that Steve had changed. He had always been charismatic, passionate, and brilliant, but when he returned, I watched him become a great manager. He was detailed in everything. Product, of course, but also in the way he ran the finance organization, the sales organization, what he did with operations and logistics. I learned from that. Steve couldn't be a good leader until he became a good manager. So when we met Bill in our weekly coaching sessions, what we discussed first and foremost was management, operations, and tactics. Bill rarely weighed in on strategic issues, and if he did, it was usually to make sure that there was a strong operating plan to accompany the strategy. What were the current crises? How quickly were we going to manage our way out of them? How was hiring going? How were we developing our teams? How were our staff meetings going? Were we getting input from everyone? What was being said? What wasn't being said? He cared that the company was well run and that we were improving as managers. It's the people. In August 2008, the website Gawker published an article titled "The 10 Most Terrible Tyrants of Tech." "Here's to the screaming ones," the article started, in a parody of the 1997 Richard Dreyfuss narrated "Think Different" Apple TV ad. The chair throwers, the death threat makers, the imperious gazers, the ones who see things differently and will stare you down until you do, too. They're not fond of rules, especially those outlined by the Human Resources Department on treating your employees with respect. The article went on to list the most notorious of the tech industry's villains: Steve Jobs, Steve Ballmer, Bill Gates, Mark Benioff, and there, second to last, the only Google representative on the list, our own Jonathan Rosenberg. Jonathan was ebullient. He was on a top 10 list, featuring the biggest stars of the industry, a hard-ass hall of fame if ever there was one. A few days later, when he walked into his one-on-one with Bill, a printed copy of the article lay on the conference table. Jonathan grinned. Bill did not. "Jonathan, this is not something to be proud of." Jonathan mumbled some form of response, which Bill cut off with a stream of expletives, concluding with a dagger to Jonathan's weak defense. "What if I were to send this to your mother? What would she think?" They both agreed that Rena Rosenberg would not be happy to see her son on that list. This is when Bill first shared with Jonathan his "It's the People" manifesto. Bill had developed this while he was at Intuit, and often repeated it practically verbatim to the two of us and other coachees. It's the people. People are the foundation of any company's success. The primary job of each manager is to help people be more effective in their job and to grow and develop. We have great people who want to do well, are capable of doing great things, and come to work fired up to do them. Great people flourish in an environment that liberates and amplifies that energy. Managers create this environment through support, respect, and trust. Support means giving people the tools, information, training, and coaching they need to succeed. It means continuous effort to develop people's skills. Great managers help people excel and grow. Respect means understanding people's unique career goals and being sensitive to their life choices. It means helping people achieve these career goals in a way that's consistent with the needs of the company. Trust means freeing people to do their jobs and to make decisions. It means knowing people want to do well and believing that they will. Numerous academic studies and constant executive platitudes show that a company's people should be treated as an asset. But executives often overlook a company's management culture when they are looking for ways to improve performance. This is a mistake. A 1999 article notes that firms that improve their management practices by one standard deviation above the mean can raise their market value by $18,000 per employee. And a Google internal study in 2008, one that Bill loved, proved that teams with managers who regularly practiced a set of 8 behaviors had lower turnover and higher satisfaction and performance. Topping the list of behaviors is a good coach. You can read more about Google's Project Oxygen study in a December 2013 Harvard Business Review article by David Garvin, "How Google Sold Its Engineers on Management." It's the people applies in other arenas as well. For example, Peter Pilling, the athletic director at Columbia, worked with Bill to shift the mission and values of his department. In Peter's case, "It's the people" became "It's the student athletes." Now, when Peter and his team think about a decision, their first consideration is the student athletes. How will that decision affect them? Is it consistent with the department's mission to maximize the opportunities for our student athletes to reach their highest levels of achievement? Do the student athletes know how much the administrators and coaches care about them? They take a holistic approach to their student athletes, trying to support them in all aspects of their lives, not just the athletic portion. Peter holds quarterly meetings with all of his head coaches, so they can have an open discussion, full candor expected, about their athletes. All of this is a direct result of Bill's principles. When Brad Smith took over as CEO of Intuit, Bill told him that he would go to bed every night thinking about those 8,000 souls who work for him. What are they thinking and feeling? How can I make them the best they can be? Ronnie Lott says, when talking about two coaches he worked closely with, Bill Walsh and Bill Campbell, "Great coaches lie awake at night thinking about how to make you better. They relish creating an environment where you get more out of yourself. Coaches are like great artists, getting the stroke exactly right on a painting. They are painting relationships. Most people don't spend a lot of time thinking about how they are going to make someone else better. But that's what coaches do. It's what Bill Campbell did. He just did it on a different field." Bill Walsh was the head coach of the San Francisco 49ers for 10 years, from 1979 through 1988. His teams won 3 Super Bowls. "What keeps you up at night?" is a traditional question asked of executives. For Bill, the answer was always the same: the well-being and success of his people. "It's the people. The top priority of any manager is the well-being and success of her people." Start with trip reports. For more than a decade, Eric held his weekly staff meetings on Mondays at 1 p.m. In many ways, these meetings were pretty much like any other staff meeting you might have been to. There was an agenda, check-ins with everyone around the table, people surreptitiously checking email and texts, all the usual stuff. Eric did one thing different from the norm, though. When everyone had come into the room and gotten settled, he'd start by asking what people did for the weekend, or if they had just come back from a trip, he'd ask for an informal trip report. This was a staff that included Larry Page and Sergey Brin. So often, the weekend report included kiteboarding tales or updates from the world of extreme fitness, but it also could skew toward the more mundane. Jonathan's daughter's latest soccer achievements, or engineering lead Alan Eustace's score on the golf course. Perhaps some of Larry's and Sergey's adventurous spirit rubbed off on Alan. In October 2014, while on sabbatical from Google, he set the world record for highest altitude free fall jump when he leapt from a balloon 135,899 feet above the Earth's surface. 14 minutes later, he landed safely, after reaching speeds of 822 miles per hour, successfully completing what Jonathan likes to call Alan's failure to commit suicide. Sometimes, if he had just returned from a business trip, Eric offered his own report, putting a Google map on the screen with pins dropped on the cities where he'd visited. He'd go city by city, talking about his trip and the interesting things he'd observed. While this conversation seemed impromptu and informal at first glance, it was a part of a communications approach that Bill had developed over the years and improved in collaboration with Eric. The objectives were twofold. First, for team members to get to know each other as people, with families and interesting lives outside of work. And second, to get everyone involved in the meeting from the outset in a fun way, as Googlers and human beings, and not just as experts and owners of their particular roles. Bill and Eric understood that there's a direct correlation between fun work environments and higher performance, with conversation about family and fun, what academics might call socio-emotional communication, being an easy way to achieve the former. Later in the meeting, when business decisions were being discussed, Eric wanted everyone to weigh in, regardless of whether the issue touched on their functional area or not. The simple communications practice, getting people to share stories, to be personal with each other, was in fact a tactic to ensure better decision-making and camaraderie. "At first, I thought it was really weird," Dick Costolo says of the trip report practice, which he also learned from Bill. "But when I started doing it and seeing it in practice, wow, it really makes a difference. The whole dynamic of the meeting changes. You get more empathy, a better mood." Dick tells the story of how he attended the staff meeting of a CEO he was mentoring, and the meeting started with hot topics and issues. No social talk whatsoever. "It really hit me in the face how jarring that was. I couldn't tell how well the team worked together and connected." Marissa Mayer developed a variation of the trip report practice when she was CEO of Yahoo. Rather than trip reports, her staff meetings started with thank yous. "My staff called it the family prayer. You have to thank another team for something that happened last week. You can't thank yourself, and you can't repeat what someone else said. This ends up being a nice way to recap the entire week." Bill believed that communications were critical to a company's success. He frequently coached us to make sure that others in the company understood what we understood. Even when you have clearly communicated something, it may take a few times to sink in. Repetition doesn't spoil the prayer. In fact, a 2002 study from Southern Methodist University shows that knowing what to share and communicate, and with whom, is an important part of a manager's job. Done right, this knowledge commonality helps the team perform better and is well worth the time it requires. Bill had us pay close attention to running meetings well. Get the one-on-one right and get the staff meeting right are tops on the list of his most important management principles. He felt that these meetings are the most important tools available to executives in running the company, and that each one should be approached thoughtfully. Staff meetings should be a forum for the most important issues and opportunities, more so than one-on-ones. "Use meetings to get everyone on the same page, get to the right debate, and make decisions. Most important issues cut across functions, but more important, bringing them to the table in team meetings lets people understand what is going on in the other teams, and discussing them as a group helps develop understanding and build cross-functional strength. This applies even to some issues that perhaps might be solved in one-on-ones, because they give the team practice in tackling challenges together." Co-founder Jerry Kaplan recalls, in his book Startup, a time when he wanted to discuss Go's growing competition with Microsoft in his one-on-one with Bill. "This was a critical topic, requiring detailed discussion of confidential and potentially controversial issues, so a one-on-one between the founder and the CEO seemed like the best forum for it. But Bill said no. He wanted to discuss and decide the issue as a team." Research confirms that team meetings are a terrific opportunity to engage people, with one 2013 study concluding that the relevance of the meeting, giving everyone a voice, and managing the clock well are key factors to achieving that engagement. This doesn't always happen. Another study from 2015 notes that more than 50% of study participants do not think that their meetings are an effective use of their time. This study covered all meetings, not just staff meetings. But still, it demonstrates that being thoughtful about preparing for staff meetings is an important management practice. Start with trip reports. To build rapport and better relationships among team members, start team meetings with trip reports or other types of more personal, non-business topics. 5 words on a whiteboard. Our one-on-one meetings with Bill were always held at his nondescript office off California Avenue, Palo Alto's quieter commercial district, a mile or so south of the glitzier University Avenue. This felt like a waste of time at first. Why couldn't he come to Google? But we quickly realized it was the right location. After all, when you go see your therapist, you go see your therapist. When making the pilgrimage to Bill, you'd enter through an unmarked door, go up the stairs to the second floor, down a hallway, give Debbie Brookfield, his longtime assistant, a hug, then go into the conference room to wait for him. For Eric's meetings, there were always 5 words written on the whiteboard, indicating the topics to discuss that day. The words might be about a person, a product, an operational issue, or an upcoming meeting. That's how they organized their talk. When we were working on this book and Eric talked about his meetings with Bill, Jonathan had to intervene. That was not how Bill started one-on-ones, Jonathan reminded Eric. While Bill did have his top 5 list of things to discuss, he didn't write them on the whiteboard for all to see. Rather, he would hold them back, like a poker player holding his cards close to the vest. After talking about family and other non-work stuff, Bill would ask Jonathan what his top 5 items were. Jonathan came to realize that this approach was Bill's way of seeing how Jonathan was prioritizing his time and effort. If Bill led off with his list, Jonathan simply could have agreed with it. The discussion of the list was in itself a form of coaching, apparently one that Eric never needed. In teaching his management seminar at Google, Bill advocated that each person should put his or her list on the board, a simultaneous reveal. That way, everyone could see where there was overlap and make sure to cover those topics. He felt that the process of merging the 2 agendas could serve as a lesson in prioritization. Regardless of whose 5 topics go on the whiteboard first, what's important is that each side has a set of topics to cover and is ready to cover them. Bill took great care in preparing for one-on-one meetings. Remember, he believed the most important thing a manager does is to help people be more effective and to grow and develop, and the one-on-one is the best opportunity to accomplish that. Once he became a full-time coach, he varied his approach to suit the person he was coaching. But as a CEO, he developed a standard format, which is what he always taught others. He always started with the small talk, but in Bill's case, the talk wasn't really that small. Oftentimes, small talk in a work environment is cursory, a quick, "How are the kids?" or chatter about the morning commute before moving on to the business stuff. Conversations with Bill were more meaningful and layered. You sometimes got the feeling that the conversation about life was more the point of the meeting than the business topics. In fact, while his interest in people's lives was quite sincere, it had a powerful benefit. A 2010 study concludes that having these sort of substantive conversations, as opposed to truly small talk, makes people happier. From the not-so-small talk, Bill moved to performance. What are you working on? How is it going? How could he help? Then we would always get to peer relationships, which Bill thought were more important than relationships with your manager and other higher-ups. One day, Jonathan spent part of his one-on-one with Bill talking about how he wasn't getting any feedback from the founders on his work. What do they want? He wondered. Bill's response was that Jonathan should not worry about top-down feedback. Rather, he should pay attention to input from his peers. What do your teammates think of you? That's what's important. They proceeded to talk about Jonathan's peers, how they generally appreciated the work he was doing, and what he could do better. From peer relationships, Bill would move on to teams. He always wanted to know, were we setting a clear direction for them, and constantly reinforcing it? Did we understand what they were doing? If they were off on something, we would discuss how we could course correct them and get them back on track. Think that everyone who works for you is like your kids, Bill once said. Help them course correct. Make them better. Then he'd want to talk about innovation. Were we making space for it on our teams? How were we balancing the inherent tension between innovation and execution? Either alone wasn't good. Striking that balance was critical. Besides having a detailed communications approach, Bill had strong opinions about being good at communicating. He was mostly old school about it, preferring face-to-face conversations or a phone call if that wasn't possible. "You shouldn't wait 4 weeks to schedule a meeting," he said. "Just get on the phone." In his CEO days at Go, if you got an email from Bill, it was a big deal. Later, when he was coach to people all over the valley, he spent evenings returning the calls of people who had left messages throughout the day. When you left Bill a voicemail, you always got a call back. He was also great at email. The tendency today is to have cascading emails, a senior person sending something to her staff, who write their own version to their people, and so on. Bill always counseled us to have one email, straight from the senior person, and over the years he practically perfected the art of writing those messages. In researching this book, we reread all of the emails we got from Bill over the years, and were constantly impressed by just how well written they all were. Concise, clear, and compassionate. When Jonathan's father passed away, Bill wrote, "I am so sorry that I didn't get to know him. He would be very proud of his loving son." He expected similar quality from everyone around him. Nirav Tolia, the co-founder and CEO of Nextdoor, a social networking site and app for neighborhoods, first met Bill in the summer of 2000, when Nirav was leading a hot .com called Epinions. Bill Gurley connected the two of them, and during their first meeting, Nirav got a lesson in Bill's approach to communications. "I had a deck prepared for him, and I always put quotes in my decks, stuff from Churchill or similar. So I go through the deck, and he let me be the peacock for a while. Finally, he stops me. 'Why do you have all those quotes in there?' he wanted to know. 'You haven't told me anything about opinions.' He pushed Nirav to scrap the quotes altogether. Just talk about what's going on and what needs to be done. "Back then, I was 90% style, 10% substance," Nirav remembers. Bill was 100% substance. Five words on a whiteboard. Have a structure for one-on-ones, and take the time to prepare for them, as they are the best way to help people be more effective and to grow. Bill's framework for one-on-ones and reviews. Performance on-job requirements. Could be sales figures. Could be product delivery or product milestones. Could be customer feedback or product quality. Could be budget numbers. Relationship with peer groups. This is critical for company integration and cohesiveness. Product and engineering. Marketing and product. Sales and engineering. Management/leadership. Are you guiding/coaching your people? Are you weeding out the bad ones? Are you working hard at hiring? Are you able to get your people to do heroic things? Innovation, best practices. Are you constantly moving ahead, thinking about how to continually get better? Are you constantly evaluating new technologies, new products, new practices? Do you measure yourself against the best in the industry/world? The throne behind the round table. At one point late in Eric's tenure as CEO of Google, he encountered something familiar to many executives, a turf war. One of his managers wanted his team to develop a mobile app for his product's users, but another manager thought that his team should be the one developing the app. The argument went on for weeks and was progressing from affable to acrimonious. When his team was confronted with a challenging decision, Eric liked to use a management technique he called the rule of two. He would get the two people most closely involved in the decision to gather more information and work together on the best solution, and usually they would come back a week or two later having decided together on the best course of action. The team almost always agreed with their recommendation, because it was usually quite obvious that it was the best idea. The rule of two not only generates the best solution in most cases, it also promotes collegiality. It empowers the two people who were working on the issue to figure out ways to solve the problem, a fundamental principle of successful mediation. And it forms a habit of working together to resolve conflict that pays off with better camaraderie and decision-making for years afterward. Research on conflict resolution proves that having a standard process for managing conflict, whether it's the rule of two or another approach, makes everyone happier and more effective. This time around, it wasn't happening. The two executives were dug in. When Eric asked Bill for advice, he replied, "You say, all right, either you two break that tie, or I will." Eric took Bill's advice, giving the two managers another week to come to an agreement. They failed, so Eric stepped in and made the decision. Bill believed that one of a manager's main jobs is to facilitate decisions, and he had a particular framework for doing so. He didn't encourage democracy. Before he arrived at Intuit, they took votes in meetings. Bill stopped that practice. Rather, he favored an approach not unlike that used in improv comedy. In improv, the entire cast is at risk and needs to work together to continue a conversation, to put off the finality of a scene until the last possible moment. Bill encouraged ensembles and always strived for a politics-free environment. A place where the top manager makes all decisions leads to just the opposite, because people will spend their time trying to convince the manager that their idea is the best. In that scenario, it's not about the best idea carrying the day. It's about who does the best job of lobbying the top dog. In other words, politics. Bill hated that. He believed in striving for the best idea, not consensus. "I hate consensus," he would growl, intuitively understanding what numerous academic studies have shown, that the goal of consensus leads to groupthink and inferior decisions. The way to get the best idea, he believed, was to get all of the opinions and ideas out in the open, on the table for the group to discuss, air the problem honestly, and make sure people have the opportunity to provide their authentic opinions, especially if they are dissenting. If the problem or decision at hand is more functional in nature, for example, primarily a marketing or finance decision, then the discussion should be led by the person with that functional expertise. When it is a broader decision, cutting across multiple functional areas, then the team leader owns the discussion. Regardless, it should involve everyone's point of view. To get those ideas on the table, Bill would often sit down with individuals before the meeting to find out what they were thinking. This enabled Bill to understand the different perspectives. But, more important, it gave members of his team the chance to come into the room prepared to talk about their point of view. Discussing it with Bill helped gather their thoughts and ideas before the broader discussion. Maybe they would all be aligned by the time they got there. Maybe not. But they had already thought through and talked through their own perspective and were ready to present it. As people present and argue ideas, things may become heated. That's to be expected and is fine. As Emil Michael, a Bill coachee and former CBO of Uber, says, "When a leader can get people past being passive-aggressive, then heated but honest arguments can happen." If your team is working well and thinking company first rather than me first, then after the fireworks subside, the best idea will likely emerge. How the leader frames this discussion matters. A 2016 study shows that when it is called a debate rather than a disagreement, participants are more likely to share information. They perceive that other participants are more receptive to dissenting opinions. The ensemble approach can be especially hard to implement when the manager in charge of the decision already knows what to do, or thinks she does. Marissa Mayer admits to having had this problem when she was at Google. Then, one day, Bill gave her a new rule. When she was discussing a decision with her team, she always had to be the last person to speak. "You may know the answer, and you may be right," he said, "but when you just blurt it out, you have robbed the team of the chance to come together. Getting to the right answer is important, but having the whole team get there is just as important." So Marissa sat, uncharacteristically quiet, while her team debated issues. She didn't like it, but it worked. She gained new respect for her team and their ability to handle problems. When the best idea doesn't emerge, it's time for the manager to force the decision or make it herself. "A manager's job is to break ties and make their people better," Bill said. "We're going to do it this way. Cut the shit. Done." Bill learned this the hard way. In his days as an exec at Apple, he had experienced the exact opposite, a place where decisions festered and the business suffered. "Apple went to its knees, you know, on those things. You had one division doing this and another division doing that, and somebody else wanted to do this. People would come to my office and ask me to make the call, but I was a sales and marketing guy. I couldn't break ties between different product groups, between the Apple II group and the Mac group. It was ugly, and nothing got done. That sat with me." Failure to make a decision can be as damaging as a wrong decision. There's indecision in business all the time, because there's no perfect answer. "Do something, even if it's wrong," Bill counseled. Having a well-run process to get to a decision is just as important as the decision itself, because it gives the team confidence and keeps everyone moving. Bruce Chizen, the former CEO of Adobe, who worked with Bill at Claris, calls this making decisions with integrity, which means following a good process and always prioritizing what is the right thing for the business rather than any individual. Make the best decision you can, then move on. Then, when you make the call, commit to it, and expect that everyone else do so as well. Dan Rosenzweig, the CEO of Chegg, a digital learning platform company, once had a situation where he and his CFO had agreed on an important financial move, only to have the CFO try to back out because of a minor issue. Dan called Bill and asked, "What should I do?" Bill told Dan about a similar situation he had once faced as CEO. Bill and his management team had decided on a particular strategy, but when Bill presented the strategy at the board meeting, his CFO, who had been on board with the plan, proclaimed that he didn't agree with Bill. After the meeting, Bill asked the CFO to not come back. Even if he didn't agree with the decision, he needed to commit to it. If he couldn't, then he was no longer a member of the team. This is consistent with the King Arthur roundtable model of decision-making that Bill described to Brad Smith when Brad became CEO of Intuit. As Brad tells us this story, he points out the model of the legendary table, with a full complement of seated knights that sits in the corner of his office. "If you have the right conversation," Bill counseled, "then 8 out of 10 times people will reach the best conclusion on their own. But the other 2 times, you need to make the hard decision and expect that everyone will rally around it. There isn't a head of that table, but there is a throne behind it." The throne behind the round table. The manager's job is to run a decision-making process that ensures all perspectives get heard and considered, and, if necessary, to break ties and make the decision. Lead based on first principles. So, how do you make that hard decision? When you are a manager trying to move your team toward making a decision, the room will be rife with opinions. Bill always counseled us to try to cut through those opinions and get to the heart of the matter. In any situation, there are certain immutable truths upon which everyone can agree. These are the first principles, a popular phrase and concept around Silicon Valley. Every company and every situation has its set of them. You can argue opinions, but you generally can't argue principles. since everyone has already agreed upon them. As Bill would point out, it's the leader's job, when faced with a tough decision, to describe and remind everyone of those first principles. As a result, the decision often becomes much easier to make. Mike McHugh was introduced to Bill not long after Mike had raised $250 million for his startup, Tell Me Networks, in the 1999 heyday of the dot-com boom. Bill sat in on Tell Me's board meetings and some of Mike's staff meetings, and counseled Mike on every important strategic decision he made, both at Tell Me and Mike's subsequent company, Flipboard. And since there were lots of strategic decisions to be made, Mike had plenty of opportunities to put into practice Bill's recommendations to decide, based on first principles. There was the time AT&T offered to pay tens of millions of dollars to license Tell Me's software. Tell Me made the first cloud-based speech recognition platform for large businesses and provided the service that answered the phones when you called companies like FedEx, Fidelity, and American Airlines. The problem with the AT&T offer was that they wanted to create a competitive product to Tell Me's. In fact, the offer was contingent upon Tell Me getting out of the cloud speech recognition business altogether. Oh, and if the deal didn't happen, AT&T, who was at the time Tell Me's largest customer, would pull all of its business. The deal had the potential to be lucrative, and Tell Me needed the money, so some members of the team were arguing to take it. They honestly thought it was the best decision to make. Mike disagreed, but he knew he wouldn't be successful if he just pushed the team to turn it down. He might win the decision, but he would lose the team. "They were all really smart people," Mike says. "They had all graduated from great colleges and were great debaters, so there were a lot of opinions. I never went to college. There was no way I was going to win an argument with that group." Mike started working right out of high school to help his family after his father died when he was 18. Furthermore, Mike had demoted himself to COO by then, bringing in former Cincinnati Bell executive John LaMacchia as CEO, and John was in favor of taking the AT&T deal. John came in as Tell Me's CEO in 2001. He left the company and Mike resumed the CEO role at the end of 2004. So Mike gave Bill a call, then took a walk along the railroad tracks that ran right outside of Tell Me's offices. He thought about the first principles involved in the decision. First, the company had a solid business model that was working. Was it smart to take on a new model, software licensing? Second, they had a good product that was, objectively, the best on the market and ahead of its time. Did they think AT&T could make a better product? Probably not. Mike convened the team and laid out these principles. Everyone agreed that they were correct, since they had been foundational for the company for a long time. The decision practically made itself. The meeting concluded in less than an hour, and the deal was off. AT&T ended up deprioritizing its effort to build a competitive product, and over time quadrupled its business with Tell Me. In 2005, AT&T merged with SBC. Mike applied the same approach when he was negotiating the sale of Tell Me to Microsoft in 2007. He was working directly with Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft at the time, and at one point the deal was on the verge of collapse because another company came in with an unsolicited offer that was higher than Microsoft's. Mike talked to Bill, thought through the company's first principles again, and realized that Microsoft was the best home for Tell Me. He wanted to sell the company to Microsoft. He flew to Redmond, Washington, and walked into Ballmer's office. "Are we going to get divorced before we even get married?" Steve asked Mike. "No," Mike responded, and explained why selling the company to Microsoft was the right outcome. Plus, the two of them had already agreed to the basic terms, and Mike had every intent of honoring that agreement. Another first principle, integrity. So from that point forward, Steve and Mike became partners in getting the deal completed, with a healthy dose of advice on both sides from Bill. Without Bill's advice to rely on first principles, the deal wouldn't have happened. Lead based on first principles. Define the first principles for the situation, the immutable truths that are the foundation for the company or product, and help guide the decision from those principles. Manage the aberrant genius. Perhaps one of the most difficult problems facing managers is what to do with the diva, the person who's a star performer but a pain to work with. We have certainly come across many of these people during our careers in high tech, and Bill always reminded us that managing these people is one of the bigger challenges of the job. He called them aberrant geniuses and said, "You get these quirky guys or women who are going to be great differentiators for you. It is your job to manage that person in a way that doesn't disrupt the company. They have to be able to work with other people. If they can't, you need to let them go. They need to work in an environment where they collaborate with other people." So how do you do this? Over the years, through lots of trial and error, and with a lot of advice from Bill, we learned this particular art. Support them as they continue to perform, and minimize time spent fighting them. Instead, invest that energy in trying as hard as possible to coach them past their aberrant behavior. As long as you can do this successfully, the rewards can be tremendous. More genius, less aberrant. "He has everything that he needs," Bill once wrote Jonathan about one of his problematic team members. "Now that you've fully supported him, you should try to get him to behave as a leader. He has all of his space. No more arguments." In our experience, aberrant geniuses can be enormously valuable and productive. They can build great products and high-performing teams. They have quick insights. They are simply better in many, many ways. And they can have both the ego and the fragility to match their outsized talent and performance. They often put a lot of energy into personal gains at the expense of peer relationships. A me-first attitude sometimes creeps through, or barges in, which can cause resentment in others and affect their performance. Here is where the art of balance comes in. There is aberrant behavior, and there is aberrant behavior. How much do you tolerate, and when is it too much? Where is that elusive boundary? Never put up with people who cross ethical lines. Lying, lapses of integrity or ethics, harassing or mistreating colleagues. In a way, these are the easier cases, since the decision is so clear-cut. The harder cases are the ones where the person doesn't cross these lines. How do you determine when the damage a person causes exceeds their considerable contributions? There's no perfect answer to this, but there are a few warning signs. All of these are coachable, but if there's no change, they shouldn't be tolerated. Does the aberrant genius break team communications? Does he interrupt others, or attack or rebuke them? Does he make people afraid to talk? Does the aberrant genius suck up too much management time? It's hard to know when an aberrant genius's behavior has become too toxic for the team to bear. But if you are spending hours upon hours controlling the damage, that's a good sign it's gone too far. A lot of that time is usually spent arguing with the person, which is rarely constructive. One time Bill was coaching a Google manager about an aberrant genius on the team, and he summed up the situation neatly. "I don't know why I'm defending him," Bill noted, "except that his brilliance is one of the things that makes us great. How can we capture the good and dismiss the bad? You can't be with him 18 hours a day." The 18 hours a day comment was an overstatement, but not a huge one. The person was requiring an inordinate amount of management damage control. He eventually left the company. A 2017 Harvard Business Review article on managing narcissists, which many aberrant geniuses may be, by Manfred F.R. Ketz DeVries, includes the recommendation to minimize direct confrontation, which is what a lot of that 18 hours consisted of. Does the aberrant genius have her priorities straight? Eccentric behavior can be okay as long as it is in the service, or intended to be in the service, of the good of the company.